Snetter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to Nailers Netter on the first week of a marathon 7-week term. So let's bring bucket loads of positivity into teachers' lives everywhere with our podcast with some big news. I know, yes, big news again. So this week I'm in conversation with Kath Murray. And this was one interview, if I'm honest, that I was extra nervous for because in a previous life at school's week, Kath was the first person to publish any of my writing. And I can remember distinctly waiting for what seemed like weeks before she finally approved it. So thank you for that, Kath. I shouldn't really have been nervous because she was absolutely brilliant to talk to, and her knowledge of education, and particularly of this week's topic around alternative provision, was a real eye-opener for me, and I know that it will be for you too. Also, Kath's life story is something else, so that bit of the interview itself is worth listening to. We also have our usual TDT section. We have podcast pedagogy with Darren Leslie. So fellow podcaster Darren Leslie will be reviewing a book. I'll also be reviewing a very old record this week, but a gold record. So I'm looking at the influence that Kraftwerk's Autobahn has had on music and on me personally. And in films, I'll be previewing Greed with Steve Coogan. And in big news, I am delighted, honoured, and absolutely humbled to announce that John Katz Education will be now proudly sponsoring Nailers Natter in association with the Teacher Development Trust. So this will mean even more interviews with leading educational authors, an opportunity for you, the listeners, to benefit from a discount. So the discount on John Katz books will be via a code which will be in the show notes on Nailers Natter on the website, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts. So check that out, and thank you to John Katz, and thank you to you all for listening. So without further ado, let's get into this week's podcast and start talking to teachers.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Teacher Development Trust section, learning from the team at TDT on best practice CPD with research.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers. Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Teacher Development Trust section, learning from the team at TDT on best practice CPD with research.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, so hi Kath and welcome to the podcast.
Hi Phil.
Thanks very much for doing this. Late night podcasting tonight, so thank you for that.
Is it later than usual?
It is later than usual, yeah. Because I think we've both had parents' evenings this week, haven't we? It's hectic
we
time.
We have. Although you as a teacher and me as a parent. So.
Well, indeed, yeah.
Mine is a little less stressful.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. So speaking of less stressful, we'll get into the nice, gentle introductory question. So can you just tell us a little bit about your career to this point and how you moved from school's week to, as you say now, to slaying dragons?
Well, the slaying dragons actually came in at the school's week point. I'll come to that. Do you want my kind of a quick rundown of my whole career or just school's week?
No, the whole career. Yeah, whole career.
Oh. All right, we'll try and move through it. It's a little bit varied, my career. And to be honest, I know I love your jingle. I've been singing it to myself all week. So I've been listening to your podcast, and the talking to teachers bit is it's wrong. I'm not a teacher, so sorry about that. But my one claim to teaching was my first job. Really, was when I was a teaching assistant in France for a year, and they called it teaching assistant, but actually they would give you entire classes. So I had 15 classes a week, no training at all, teaching all secondary school English. In fact, it was such a scandal that while I was there, the entire teaching staff in Paris went on strike because they were using people like me as cheap teachers because they were paying us like teaching assistants and using us to actually teach English classes with no training. So quite rightly, they all went on strike. Which is quite awkward because they were all kind of sneaking around in the school and I was trying to work out what was happening. They're like, we're going to go on strike tomorrow about teaching assistants. And it was kind of embarrassing because we all got on really well, but it was quite funny. So yeah, that was my teaching experience. And I do remember one of my lasting memories was my year seven equivalent class, who halfway through the year, one of the girls said to me, "Miss, why don't you cry? We used to make the last teaching assistant cry all the time." And I felt really good then. I was like, well, I'm not crying. It was tough though. So yeah, after that, I was invited to go teach English in Virginia, US, for a program of French students to kind of to hone their English. That was quite fun. My first trip to the US, off the back of that. Came back, finished my degree, which is in French and philosophy. Applied to the Foreign Office, failed. And then I think I was so upset that I went off to Europe, traveled around Europe, and had babies and kind of dropped out of the whole career path. So I spent the first 10 years of my career really kind of working from home, doing translations, interpretation locally in Spain. So I lived in Spain for 6 years. After 6 years there, I realized that I was making a living online and could live anywhere in the world. So made the choice to move to Costa Rica and thought I'll go for a year. I'd heard of this amazing school in the Cloud Forest called the Cloud Forest School, where they did environmental education and tropical biology for the kids. So I thought, amazing. Cheaper living there as well. And I could earn online. So it was a no-brainer. So we moved to Costa Rica for a year, stayed there for six. It was partly living the dream. It was really gorgeous, amazing, lovely little community in the Cloud Forest of Quakers, American Quakers who'd moved there in the 50s to avoid the Korean War draft. Plus a whole community of local Costa Rican farmers kind of who'd all intermarried in the 1950s. So there's this really interesting community. And then kind of modern influx of tropical biologists come to study the Cloud Forest. So it was crazy. The nerdy thing to do was to know all your local bird calls. So it was a really fun and interesting time in my life. While I was there, I got really fed up with doing translations. I decided to train as a yoga teacher, opened a yoga studio on the second floor of our house, got bored of that, got a job in the Environmental Research Institute. And then that was, I guess, my second stint in teaching. Somehow managed to wing it to teach a course to university students in something called service learning. So service learning was basically, I saw it as basically being a cultural interpreter for American students coming to Costa Rica and wanting to help the local community. And my job was really to kind of give them a framework for what that meant, what the cultural differences might be, what projects they could usefully do, and kind of liaise with the local community to help manage that relationship and make sure that both sides were kind of mutually benefited by that. It was really interesting time. I loved it.
I think this has to be the most interesting starter question we've ever done. And you said it at the beginning that the jingle says talking to teachers. And yeah, I mean, you know, it's not exclusively, but we have mainly spoke to teachers. But this just shows what there is out there. So I'm just writing this down. Teaching assistant, France, the US, Costa Rica, learning bird calls, yoga teaching, environmental science. And I was just going to ask you about schools week. I mean, wow, this is amazing. Keep going.
All right. But I moved back to England about 6 years ago. And the thing is that I moved back, I'd split from my partner from their dad and I'd moved back. And at the time it was just me and the two kids when I moved back. And I was mid 30s and I actually found it really difficult to find work. Because I moved back to London to be near my brother and his family who lived here. And he kind of helped me out and supported me for a few months while I looked for work. But I found it really hard because, and I know a lot of people, they tell you, and they would always say when I came back, oh, use your network. I didn't have a network because I moved away after university. I'd grown up with a weird combination of factors, which was kind of a very quite strange, religious, kind of small group. You might also almost say cultish, kind of small church environment. So I'd kind of split away from, and then I hadn't really got this connection of networks that you're supposed to have. I hadn't really got the social skills. So even I went to Oxford University. I didn't have a single contact from my Oxford University days because I was quite socially isolated at that time in my life. So I hadn't kept them. So I came back to England and everyone said, oh, use your network to get a job. I didn't have one. So I enrolled in a journalism course because I thought, well, I can write. So I did a kind of crash course in journalism, what they call the NCTJ qualification. And halfway through that, I was running out of money. I applied for a job at Netmums because I thought I'm a mum and now I'm kind of a journalist, so try that. And I got a job. It was an editorial assistant position. This is how low my standards were. 18 grand in London at the age of 36 with two children to look after. But I thought, you know what, it's a job, it's a starting position. So I did that for 2 months, got very bored, but thankfully an internal role came up for managing editor. So I jumped from editorial assistant to managing editor in 2 months, which was nice. And then worked there for 6 months. And then I saw Laura's job advert and everything changed. This is a Dragon Slayer moment. So she wrote, you know what happened was that I was looking for jobs and you read through job like descriptions and they're so dull. I mean, they're just a format, right? I saw this job description and honestly, I just went, whoever wrote that job description, I need to work for them. Like, that's it. I have to. So I was just like, I was determined. I knew this was a job for me. So in the job description, she said, you know, if you want to know more, book in a phone call with me on this online system. And I thought, oh, that's fun. I'll book in a phone call. So I remember at like 6:30 in the morning before I left for my job, having this conversation in the garden with Laura and getting so excited about it. And then we met up for like a coffee and a pret-a-manger somewhere in Westminster. It was all very glamorous for me. And had a chat about it. And I brought her some like samples of work that I thought that, you know, how she could improve schools week. So it was all this, you know, it was great. It was a great conversation and I loved it. And then went for interview formally soon after that and never looked back.
No, indeed, indeed. So in terms of from there to where you are now, what's the transition been like there and what kind of things are you doing with, it's integrated, I pronounced that correctly.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, or just integrated. with a big ED on the bottom, I don't know, it's sort of a thing. I was there at Schools Week and FE Week for 3 years. It was amazing. I absolutely loved it. I mean, I got such a baptism of education policy, both the schools and FE. I mean, it was really hard work, really intense. But you couldn't have got a better training in terms of education policy working under Laura and the whole team, just brilliant. The editor now, John, is just absolutely brilliant too. Just so much to learn from those people. But it was 3 years. I was exhausted. I was, looking after the kids and I just kind of wanted something that was a bit more 9 to 5. So I was looking around, but also at the same time, this amazing opportunity came up at the Centre for Social Justice, which was pretty much a dream job as well, which was a think tank role, 3 year fixed term, looking at how to reduce preventable exclusions and improve the quality of alternative provision. And so it's bringing together research and then developing policy and then lobbying on those policy changes. Absolutely brilliant. So that's called the Integrated Partnership Programme. And there are 19 partner organisations. And we at the CSJ are like the hub organisation. So we kind of, they're all running interventions, a lot of them in schools. And we are kind of the policy and research partner at the hub of it. And one of our roles and one of my jobs is to kind of keep in touch with all those partners, see what they're doing. And any of the good stuff kind of feed it into our policy thinking. So on the ground, we've got people like the Anna Freud Centre, who's doing their kind of family school model about parental engagement through AP. We've got Education Data Lab as a data partner. Education Policy Institute has been doing amazing work data-wise. And then kind of working on the ground, we've got Teach First, Whole Education. We've got Relationships Foundation, Right to Succeed. I mean, so many partners, I won't bore you with naming them, but there is a website, which is integrated.org.uk, and you can see them all on there. But basically, they're all doing a series of interventions, and the only thing that unites us is reducing preventable exclusions and improving the quality of AP. And apart from that, it's quite a loose partnership around that. So it gives a lot of freedom, but a lot of access to a great network of people. So, yeah, it's amazing.
And this, in terms of a topic, is something that, you know, I said to you off air, if you like, that very, very interested in from a sort of day-to-day point of view. So as you know, I mean, I bang on about it every single week. I work in Blackpool. So if you look at them, we're going to talk about the unexplained pupil exits, which is published by the Education Policy Institute. But Blackpool's obviously very high up in terms of the use of AP and the exclusions as well. So we might contextualise a little bit of that possibly for further on. But just tell us a little bit about your work for Integrated and CSJ and your vision for fewer exclusions and better AP.
Yeah, so one of the best ways to do it is actually to talk about a couple of our partners. And one of them is working in Blackpool. So I don't know if you've come across them. So Right to Succeed.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, of course.
Okay. So they're one of our partners on this project and their Blackpool work is part of the integrated project. And so they are working with all of the secondary schools in Blackpool and the Pru.
Yep.
And one of the amazing things that they've achieved is to get all of the schools and the Pru on the same GL assessment kind of software. And I think you can't underestimate that, because when we're talking about tracking people progress, they're using literacy to see whether if you do a targeted intervention in year 7 and 8 on literacy, whether you can actually reduce the number of kids who disengage from education and ultimately get excluded or moved out into AP. And the fact that they've, I mean, it sounds like a very technical, small issue, but actually to get everybody working on the same platform so you can get a baseline of what other kids' literacy is that's comparable. And so if a child moves from a mainstream into the Pru and then out again, you can actually track their progress in a way that is, you know, comparable. It's just, it's a really great, great thing. And they've done it through a lot of relationship building. So that's you know, brilliant. I don't know, what kind of interactions have you had with their work?
Well, I mean, one of the things I do on the podcast is I don't necessarily go into the absolute details of what the day-to-day job's like, but all the schools are working collaboratively together across the literacy project. There's also a behaviour project, of which Right to Succeed are part of all of that as well. So it's right. Very much just the stuff that you're talking about there is very much what is going on the ground. And it's, you know, it's a great sense of collaboration across all the schools that we are working together on all of these different things.
Yeah, great. That's good to hear. No, there's a lot of work going on in Blackpool. It's really exciting. I got a whistle-stop tour of it. I wish I could have spent more time. I just kind of whizzed around to all the schools on a day, which was crazy, but amazing to just hear from some of the teachers working on the project. It's brilliant. Good stuff. So, yeah, there's the difference, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard of, which is about getting teachers from mainstream to go and spend 2 years in a Pru and in a leadership position on teaching and learning, so trying to improve the teaching and learning in the Pru. Or the AP Academy, and then going back into a leadership position in mainstream in order to lead on behaviour in the mainstream with the ultimate aim of preventing exclusions in the first place. So they're doing brilliant work. Relationships Foundation is doing a research project into, they want to work with every Pru and AP in the country, and they want to measure the strength of relationships in those APs and correlate whether strong relationships, what kind of that has to do with good outcomes for those children, so kind of destinations after they leave education. And then Social Finance is another one who's working with two local authorities to kind of do a proper kind of multi-agency 2-year project around exclusions and their strategy on exclusions. So that's just four of the partners. There's loads more, but it's exciting. They're doing some really interesting stuff, and I can't wait to kind of see them progress over the next couple of years.
Definitely. So if we go into that unexplained pupil exits from school published in October from the Education Policy Institute, and that's a really, really important read if people haven't read that already. So could you just take listeners through the report and its key recommendations in terms of policy, guidance, etc.?
I will do. First, I'll give a shout out to the authors, Joe Hutchinson, Whitney Connor Jennings, who are doing brilliant stuff at the Education Policy Institute. And it's just a privilege to have partners like that, because they've shared some data with us recently that allowed us to do our latest blog. And just to have a partnership like that is brilliant. So, yeah, big shout out to them and to Natalie Pereira, who runs the EPI, and for kind of supporting that work. So, yeah, they studied cohorts. So their cohort of secondary school children that did their GCSEs in 2017 was one of their cohorts, and they found that of that cohort, 1 in 10 pupils had an unexplained exit from school. So that's basically, you take away all the reasons that you could possibly leave a school and be recorded for that. So permanent exclusions, a house move, so if the child's address changed, if they moved abroad, so basically anything that is parentally driven, they controlled for on the data. But even after doing that, 1 in 10 pupils left a school during that time, and 4 in 10 never actually returned to any mainstream school that they could find. And so also they saw that was increasing. So the 2014 cohort, so who finished GCSEs 3 years earlier, had 1 in 11 unexplained exit. So it seems to be, well, at least in that sample, it was increasing. The rate was increasing. And then some of the worrying findings were, as in a lot of these things, you find that it affects disadvantaged pupils more. So 1 in 3 of all looked after children had an unexplained exit. 1 in 4 with identified mental health needs, etc. Also special educational needs in general, poorer pupils and from Black ethnic backgrounds had a higher than average rate of unexplained exits from schools. So, I mean, I don't know if I need to explain what an unexplained exit, why that's important. I mean, some of these could be managed moves to other schools, the reason it's still important to look at that, because I know a lot of people say managed move policy can be really good, is that sometimes you'll see, like Looked After Children, for example, have several school moves over their school career. And so one managed move in one case might be okay for a child. If somebody's having multiple managed moves, that's really worrying in terms of the continuity of their education. And not just Looked After Children, kind of any child that's being bumped around the system. The RSA is actually doing research and they call it pinball kids. So these kids who just, they're never stopping anywhere. So a lot of the Looked After Children because they're moving boroughs, but a lot of kids who are just not settling in a mainstream school and have some instability in their life and they're just being bumped around. We need to watch out for who's looking out for those kids.
No, definitely. So in terms of guidance for readers to that, listeners to this and kind of school leaders, what recommendations were made there?
So the EPI said, as every report on this topic ever says, and our upcoming reports will say exactly the same, we need better data and monitoring of children in AP. It's always a problem. So the data for children in AP is not as good as children in mainstream schools, and that's because there's quite a lot of use of independent provision, etc. There are various reasons why it's not good. There's also dual rolling is not very well monitored. So kids, I'm sure lots of listeners have children like this at their schools who might go to the PRU or the AP long term, but will stay on the roll of their mainstream school and be dual rolled to the PRU or the AP, which can be really good practice, but they don't appear in the data of children being educated in AP. So it's quite hard to get a sense of really who's being educated in AP. So yeah, better data and monitoring. They also said that we should reward inclusive schools and maybe use accountability measures to hold schools accountable for children who move away. That's been mooted a lot of times, at least since Michael Gove's time, this idea that mainstream schools could be held accountable for the results of excluded children. And then they also changes to the funding system, which again we are asking for, to promote early intervention in schools, to do the preventative work to actually prevent exclusions. And so that schools who are currently penalised because if they spend lots of money on prevention, it has to come from their own budget. The idea is that the funding system should not incentivise exclusion. It should be such that schools, if they want to put in the effort to support that child and the early intervention to support that child, can have a way of doing that that's affordable for them.
Great. So you just mentioned briefly there in the recommendations and the guidance that, you know, keeping a track across the AP is quite difficult, and the AP census is incredibly opaque, as you said in the integrated blog.
Yeah.
So what constitutes AP for people who, I mean, I'm presuming that a lot of listeners will have come across alternative provision, but, you know, some schools use that much more than others. So what constitutes AP and why are there such huge disparities? And I mentioned at the beginning, you know, Knowsley, Blackpool, other areas seem to have a bigger uptake. So maybe what's driving that?
Okay, so there are two ways to look at AP. We can look at school types and we can look at pupil types. So I'll start with the school types. So you've got PRUs, you've got AP Converter Academies, which are old, the former PRUs. You've got AP Free Schools, which set up as APs. And then that's a state-maintained sector. And that's easier to track data in because they fill in the annual school census, just like mainstream schools. Then you have all the stuff that's recorded only on what's called the AP Census, which is filled in once a year in January by the local authority. And so it's not the same quality or level of data collected in that census or the same frequency. And that includes independent AP, unregistered provision. It could be AP pupils who've been placed in independent special schools. So there's a whole range of things. It's a bit of a catch-all, the AP census, basically anything else that you as a local authority is paying for educationally. But it's not broken down into much detail. So when we try and break down the data of who's in that list of data, we can't really work it out very easily.
And I was going to say about in terms of the areas, why do you think that AP is used more by certain areas than others? And that's a difficult question, maybe, but in general.
That's a really difficult question. No, and we've actually, it's a big difference. So actually, what we've done in the report that's coming up. We've got a report which we're kind of provisionally calling cold spots report. So we're trying to look at the differences in quality of AP, quality of provision across the country. So we're kind of pulling out the cold spots where kids have virtually no chance of getting a decent outcome from AP. And as part of that work, we've actually kind of created graphs of rates of children in AP and then by Ofsted rating. And when you actually look at the rates, I mean, they are wildly different. So we've got places that are, you know, from 100 kids in every 10,000. So that's like, what's the 110,000? It's like one in a thousand. One in a thousand kids is an AP, you know, all the way down to virtually none in AP. And why that is the case is really hard, and we haven't actually found why yet. It can be differences in funding arrangements. It can be differences in availability of AP. So there was a really good research report last year published by the government, commissioned by someone called the ISOS Partnership. And it's called, if anyone's really geeky about this subject, it's a brilliant report. It's called Market Analysis of AP, I think it is. And it basically, it found that it's supply-driven and it's not demand-driven AP. So if you open the APs, the children will come. So there are areas where there just isn't good AP, or there isn't even, there's barely any AP at all available, and so it can't be used. So that could be a big reason for the differences in rates in AP. It's just that they don't have the schools available. And then there's differences. So there's differences. There's things hidden in the data as well. So if you look at the data for Kent, it looks like Kent has virtually nobody in AP. But actually, that's because they have a policy that every child in AP is dual-rolled with their mainstream school. So they appear on the data as if they're on mainstream, but they're actually in AP. And again, that could be a really great thing if the mainstream school then keeps in touch with that child and they've got the option to go back. There's a reintegration kind of plan in place that could be really positive. If it were just a way, if a local authority were doing that just as a way of kind of hiding how much they're using alternative provision, it's not great because we can't really see it. But this is part of the work that we're doing, is pulling apart the data and actually producing graphs of all of these different scenarios to try and work out what the use of AP actually is. But yeah, in terms of AP, so I was talking about the school types. You can also look at it from the pupil perspective. And I think this is really important. And I don't think, I think people who work in AP are very aware of this. In general, in the education system, we might not be as aware of this. And this is that, again, the ISOS Partnership report found four different categories of student need, kind of four broad categories, but it's a bit crude. But the people who end up in AP can be, for example, people there just for one-off incidents. So something happened at school, they got excluded. And those kids probably just need a bit of work, a bit of investigation into what happened, and then to be reintegrated in the mainstream as soon as possible. You've got kids who are engaged with education, but actually are not driving a mainstream at all. So they want to go to school, but it's just not working out for them. And they just need a smaller, slightly different bespoke curriculum in smaller groups, etc. So they might come out for part-time from their school and be in AP for a few days a week, which just helps them to kind of stay engaged with school. Then you've got vulnerable pupils. These are pupils who might be suffering abuse or neglect at home. They might have mental health difficulties, and they just need a therapeutic learning environment because they're just not coping with the mainstream. And then finally, you've got your disengaged pupils, which were typically they have very low attendance. They might have complex family circumstances. They might be care experienced. They're probably at risk of criminal involvement, of gangs, etc. And the key thing about, I mean, this crude kind of categorization of the different types of people in AP. The key thing about this is, in a lot of places, all of those children are put in one school. And so what you're doing is taking all the children who basically aren't working out in mainstream for some reason, for whom mainstream isn't working, and you're sticking them all in one place. And as you can hear from that list, they're very different types of children, and they need very different things. And putting them all together is often not the best for a lot of those children. So actually, one of the really good practices that I've seen are areas where they have a kind of triage and diagnosis process. So as soon as a child is referred into AP, they give them an assessment and they say, what does this child need? So one multi-academy trust in Plymouth, ACE academies, they do it. They call it internalizing behaviors and externalizing behaviors. So in terms of mental health, they'll say kind of the externalizing might be the kind of criminal justice involved children or the ones who are demonstrating aggression, and the internalizing behaviors might be the children who are anxious or school refusing, etc. And they separate them out and they put them in two different APs from the beginning. And I just think we need more awareness of that you can't just dump all kids together in a prue and expect it to work.
So in terms of sort of locations of APs, and you've said that there's many different provisions in different areas, but is it predominantly prues, or are they more creative in terms of using, you know, work experience or things like that? Is that acceptable? Is that classed under alternative provision as well?
Yeah, so a lot of that is. Work experience wouldn't be, but yes, kind of some vocational provisions would
So
if a child's going out on one day a week to do kind of a mechanics course or something more vocational, that could be classed as alternative provision. And often the PRU as well, won't, they might have 200 kids on roll, but you won't walk into the Peru and see 200 kids because a lot of them will be sent to other providers. So often they do function as a place where kids are referred on to other providers. I mean, that does happen too.
Yeah. So you also recommended that the government should publish, alongside its exclusion rates, a combined figure that accounts for all AP. So, I mean, you've mentioned that a little bit before, but just tell us why we think that's really important.
Well, basically, there has been a lot of media pressure to not exclude children. And I don't think that's a bad thing, in the sense that, yes, we should be aware of what happens to children after they get excluded. We should care about the outcomes of these children. At the same time, I support the right of head teachers to take that decision. And I think the guidance, if it's followed correctly, is good guidance. It's not always followed correctly. And decisions are made to exclude children that I don't think should have been made. So that's a different issue. But the point is, if there's pressure not to exclude, instead of doing what would be good practice, which is, let's look at early intervention, let's look at identifying children at risk of exclusion, see how we can support them early, some local authorities and schools are instead finding other ways to hide their exclusion rates. Or they're doing it in tandem. They're saying, okay, we'll do an early intervention program, but also we're worried about a high exclusion rate, so we'll change it in the data. So in the data we can see this. So the EPI data shows that in their 2017 cohort, 4,500 about pupils got a PX, got a permanent exclusion, but more than that, about 5,500 pupils actually were moved permanently into AP, but there's no permanent exclusion on their record. So more than double the amount of children went permanently into AP, but without a permanent exclusion. So, I mean, some people would be surprised that that's happening. Some people aren't, because that's just what happens in their area. But Ofsted tends to call this off-rolling in most cases. And so, for example, a good example of that was Knowsley. You mentioned Knowsley before. So Knowsley has a permanent exclusion rate of 2 children per 1,000. If you add in unexplained exits to AP, so permanent moves to AP, they have 83 of those. So it jumps from at the bottom of the table to second highest on the table when you add in those moving to AP. So I don't think it's fair to say Knowsley has almost zero exclusions, because it doesn't. There are 85 pupils in every 1,000 being moved into AP. How is that no exclusion? So I just think we have to publish it. And we have to publish it just because we need to see what's happening. I just don't think we can have a proper conversation unless the data is correct.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just thinking about the question that's coming up next is, and this is something that, you know, depending on listeners' context, depending on the schools that they're working in, you know, you're hearing these words AP and exclusion. So is a managed move to alternative provision better than a permanent exclusion?
So I have advocated in the past, and this is what I understand as Ofsted's position as well, is that there are two ways to use AP. Either you permanently exclude a child because they hit the threshold for permanent exclusion, which is a very specific set of circumstances, and you have to go through a process of proving it to your governing board. You have that level of scrutiny, etc. Or if you think that AP is the best place for that child, but they haven't merited a permanent exclusion, then you should dual role them with the AP. So you keep them on your school roll. You send them to the AP for a set time and say, you know what, I think they might thrive here. Could you take them for a term? Can we see how it goes? Can we have a conversation about how they're getting on? Can we have a conversation with the parents about, let's try this, and with the child, and say, let's try this for a bit and see if it helps you, and then see if you want to come back into mainstream. So the managed move to AP is a bit of a fudge, because basically what happens is they have that conversation with the parents and the child and say, I think that AP is the best place for your child. We don't want to permanently exclude them. And what they'll often say is, but if they carry on this mainstream school, they're at risk of permanent exclusion. And then what happens is that the parent gets scared of the permanent exclusion, and they say they'll often agree to move into AP in a managed move scenario to avoid the permanent exclusion. Now, if the school explicitly says you will get a permanent exclusion if you don't do a managed move, that is against the statutory guidance. So that's not allowed. That's actually illegal. But if you do it in such a way that it's a conversation that's a bit more subtle, it's not, and there's no piece of paper that proves it, et cetera, these practices just have the potential to be coercive and to not stand up to scrutiny. So I'm not very comfortable with the managed move to AP. But But there are some people who I know are good practitioners who've said to me, okay, but listen, Kath, a managed move into AP, if a permanent exclusion is, we all know it's inevitable, this child is just not behaving, it's going to be persistent disruptive behavior, there's going to be an incident, etc. We know that AP is best for them. Don't you think that, you know, that avoiding the stigma and the brutal shock of permanent exclusion and that word of excluded, which is a really negative label to have put on you, don't you think it's better for them to avoid that and have it in a conversation so they feel that they're part of this process? So I hear that. I still say, why not just dual role? But the problem with dual rolling is you've got a funding issue there. If you're on dual role, the school has to pay for the AP place. The local authority won't often do that, except in some specific local authorities. So I understand there's a funding disincentive to do that. So what I've said for now is, okay, I hear that it can be fuzzy, but in that case, let's just publish all the rates. Because if we publish all the tables of managed moves into AP plus permanent exclusions, at least we know that the decisions are being made. Then I can believe you. Okay, the decisions are being made for the best interest of the child. You're not, the decisions aren't being made to just have better statistics. Because if they're going to be published anyway, that stops being a reason to do managed move into AP. And then we'll see if people are still doing managed move into AP because it's best for the child, or if it was just a way to get around the exclusion rates.
No,
that makes sense.
It absolutely does, and it's really fascinating stuff for me to listen to. I'm sure it is for the listeners as well. So in terms of those children that are removed from mainstream, whether it's, you know, for a limited amount of time or a certain number of days per week via the dual rolling or just moved into alternative provision altogether, how can we go about improving education for children who are removed from the mainstream?
Okay, so for AP, and this is the research project we're doing at the moment on the kind of policy paper, and I think that the government in its manifesto stated quite crudely, we will expand alternative provision. I like to think we can interpret that and kind of lobby for that being not just expansion of alternative provision, but improvement of and increasing the quality of. And that there are things that they've said that indicate that this is definitely where they want to go in terms of raising the standards in AP, which is a good thing. So there are certain things that can help. Workforce development. There are areas, we've just been looking at the stats, there are areas in the country where there are 100% of teachers in AP are unqualified. There are areas where 100% are qualified too, but Hartlepool, for example, has 0% qualified teachers and it doesn't even have any on a training route, which is quite shocking. And then you've got people at the top, like Greenwich, Haverhill, St Helens, Manchester, Trafford, which all have 100% of teachers in AP being qualified teachers. But we need to make sure that those areas like Hartlepool, that doesn't happen. That's not okay. So we need to treat our children in AP with the same esteem that we would in mainstream. We wouldn't accept in a mainstream school that none of your teachers are qualified teachers. And so that has to be the same in AP. Same with the premises and the facilities. There are some APs that feel like a school, they look like a school, and some great AP heads are doing things to make that the ethos. So they wear uniforms, they have London East Alternative Provision in East London even has a prospectus, which I think is brilliant. And when you go there and you sit down with a parent in the induction meeting, here's our prospectus, here's our school values, this is what we're about, this is what your child can expect, here's your careers pathways, etc. I mean, calling your school a school is another thing rather than a PRU and a unit, etc. The children who go there want to feel part of something. They don't want to feel like they've been thrown out of the education system. Yes, they're attending every day and they need to be valued in that place. So yes, some of the buildings feel like schools, some of the buildings are still unacceptable. Some of them are stuck on industrial estates. I went to one in Birkenhead, which was just totally unsuitable. And those teachers are doing an amazing job in an awful, tiny little hut stuck on the edge of an industrial estate where those children, you can imagine going to school every day, do they feel valued? Do they feel like they matter? Do they feel like people care that they're getting a decent education? So I think it's about esteem as well. It's about treating those people with the same care and respect that we would mainstream children. And then part of that as well, that's what I'm going to start advocating for, and it might be controversial. I actually think we need parental choice in AP. And that is not happening. So the moment you get excluded from school, you just get thrown wherever the local authority says you should go. So the local authority decides. And I think historically, this is because exclusion is seen as a punishment. So you've misbehaved, so you've kind of lost the right to choose. A bit like the prison, you know, you just dumped here, you're stuck here, this is where you shall go to this institution. It's that mentality of you broke the law, therefore you lose your choice. And I think that is the wrong way to look at it, because as we've seen, the reasons for ending up in AP are very varied. And a parent talking to the local authority about being involved in that meeting and that choice, and the local authority saying, look, we have three providers in this borough. This one is catered more for this type of child. This one is bigger classes. This one is smaller. This one has more vocational, et cetera. Involving them in that conversation is surely only a good thing. And I know there's logistical difficulties with that. I know there's not always places available, but that's the same with mainstream schools. You don't always get into the school that you want to, but at least you're involved in the conversation. And then finally, two more things. Performance measures. I think all the good AP heads I have spoken to, in fact, every AP head I have spoken to, has said to me, yes, we would welcome performance measures. There's no benchmarking. Nobody's telling us what we should be achieving. Nobody's telling us what the standards are or the expectations are for AP. And I know we gripe a lot in mainstream about performance measures, and maybe they wouldn't be the same and they wouldn't be Progress 8. There'd be different measures adapted for AP. There could be more of a focus on destinations. There could be maybe more of a focus on progress of attendance. So you might not measure raw attendance. You might measure progress since the child entered the PRU to when they leave, you know. So it could be different. But what they're saying to me, people, is nobody's recognizing it when we do well, because nobody knows what good looks like. So I think we need to develop those. And we at CSJ are going to be developing some draft ones to try and lobby on the government and bringing them in. Mm-hmm. And then finally, sorry, one more thing I would say in terms of improvement is recognizing this crossover between AP and social emotional mental health, SEMH. And I'm playing with this idea at the moment of, should we have in every local authority a mainstream school that looks and feels and is like a mainstream school, but it's probably a smaller one? It might be like AP and XP in Doncaster, which has 50 students in every year, and they cap it there and it won't take any more. They have 25 students in a class. They have 12 students in a crew group, what they call crew at the beginning of the day. They have 45 minutes in their little crew. It's like a tutor group, but it's like they call it crew because it's about supporting each other. So they have 45 minutes of support in the morning with their 12 peers and their tutor or their crew leader. So that's a mainstream school and a mainstream budget, but it is nurturing. And I would put a child with mental health needs in that school. So what I'm playing with is this idea of, should every local authority have a school like that is mainstream? So you don't have an EHCP to get in there, but it's known that if there are children who are struggling in a big mainstream environment, could actually request a transfer. I mean, it's logistically complicated, but I just think we need a recognition that a lot of these children have mental health needs, which is why they're not coping in a mainstream school.
No, completely.
There we go. There's my list.
No, brilliant. And in terms of, you mentioned that the government's kind of focus is going to be around, maybe increasing funding for this sort of thing. So how do you feel about, or is there any evidence out there of schools doing this? Schools almost developing their own alternative provision, whether it's within the site or the campus or, where the school is, and actually, designing a curriculum that fits those pupils to allow them to be able to access things that slightly sits outside the mainstream school, but still, if you like, is kind of dual roled and the school's accountable for it. Is there anyone doing some good work in that area?
Yeah, I mean, I know schools that are trying it, and there's been no evaluation of those things. And so the Evening Standard, the London Evening Standard, launched a campaign recently to fundraise for inclusion units within schools, so what you're kind of talking about there. And I think that with a project of that size, we need an evaluation alongside it. And I know they're talking about doing that. So we need to know what works. Because Matthew Moss High School, we've been working with in Rochdale. They've got a great coordinator for their inclusion unit. He's just, really compassionate about those children and really got high expectations for them. So they're kind of taken out of mainstream. And then in a lot of those good practice models, Inspiration Trust is trialing one as well. We're working with them in Norfolk. So in a lot of those models, the good thing about having it on site is that those children, you can do some focus work with them, but then they can gradually go back into the mainstream classes. So they might say, look, I get on with my English teacher. I haven't had any problems in that class. So they can still go to that English class, but they can come out for the rest of the classes and do more focused work. They can have some more one-on-one. They can do some catch-up. They can have conversations about behavior and why they're not engaging and why they're not managing in that classroom. But you've got that chance of, okay, now we're going to do history as well. Like, let's try you going back into history. So I think there's benefits to having those kind of things on site, definitely. There is a danger if we just all shout about in-school inclusion units that there could be really poor practice in this area as well. So what nobody wants is that you just have a designated classroom with somebody who's not really a specialist, and they just sit there all day and they're kind of isolated within a mainstream environment. Actually, a really good AP school could be way more inclusive for those children than being isolated within a mainstream school. So I don't think it's clear exactly what the components of good practice are in that area, but I think we need to do some research on that.
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of thinking about the qualified teachers and the access to qualified teachers will be easier in that sense, won't it? And also the accountability will be more because the pupils are still both physically and, you know, in terms of results on the site of the school. But you're right, it's very early days. I think a lot of schools, you know, just kind of anecdotally from people that I talk to, so, you know, some schools are spending huge amounts of money on alternative provision that would be better, arguably, potentially, better spent in terms of developing their own staff, their own provision, their own bespoke curriculum for their students in their context.
Yeah, it could be. Absolutely. If it's done well, it could be. I've also heard stories of schools who do that. They kind of get to this level where they're, you know, they're spending so much each year on alternative provision that they say exactly that. Let's hire a staff member. Let's do it in-house. Then they kind of try that and realize it doesn't work. And then they want. So it depends. What I think we need in all of this is models of good practice. And so one of the things that we're doing actually is we're building a kind of online knowledge hub, which we want to be the kind of go-to place for all of this stuff. So it will be all the data about exclusions, be links to all the report on AP and exclusions. It will have a networking facility for people working in this area, but it will always also, as we go along and as we get the evidence from these trials, it will include examples of good practice case studies that people can look at, and then people kind of contacts that people can get in touch with to say, how did you do this in this school? You know, look at the outcomes from it and then try and, you know, see if they can learn from that.
Definitely, definitely. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you so far, Kath. I'm just going to ask a couple of more questions, if that's all right. So we've mentioned quite a lot of reports and a lot of things about the partners that you're working with. So I'll put it on the show notes in the podcast introduction. But if you just can signpost us a little bit to, you know, blogs, Twitter, the websites and some of these papers that we've discussed.
Sure. So I'm on Twitter at Kath_Murray. There we have a lot of conversations about AP with the hashtag #ThisIsAP. PRUSAP is a great network to follow. PRUSAP, that's a kind of association of heads of AP, and there's some really good conversations happen around that. The project website is integrated.org.uk. I hesitate over it because our program's called Integrated. Kieran Gill at The Difference runs a great conference called Included. And so I always, like, when I'm going to go say Integrated, I always worry that I'm going to say the wrong word, but it is Integrated. They included the conference. We integrated the program. So that's online. And then in conferences coming up, I'm speaking at Educating Links in a couple of weeks, although the podcast might not be out by then. Then at Blackpool Research Ed in, do you know when that is?
I should do. I'm running it.
Oh, 21st of March.
It's me, 21st of March. Yeah, yeah. Me and Simon Cox are running that. So yeah, if I didn't know that one, he would kill me. And yes, I
mean, good.
Well, indeed. And last time I did see you, it was I sat behind you in a conference at I think it was a National Research Ed conference actually in the afternoon. So I know, it's just, I get around a lot of these different conferences.
Yeah.
And the beauty of being a podcast is people don't know what I look like, so I kind of slip in and out of rooms. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's nobody
unnoticed.
Knows. It's
very
great.
Good, very good. Oh, one more festival recommendation before we end. Do you ever go to Wellington? It's probably quite a long way to come down. The Festival of Education.
I was due to, but I didn't get there last year, no.
Oh, that's a shame. So I'm running I'm part of the content production team for that festival, but also I'm running an inclusion strand. So we'll be talking about exclusions, AP and inclusion in a dedicated strand this year, again, as we did last year. So, yeah, it's always a brilliant conference if you can make it. It's on a school day, so it's, you know, it depends on being able to get a release out of school, obviously. Yeah. But, yeah, that'd be a good one.
Well, just to finish with a couple of thank yous. So, first of all, thank you for being someone who published one of my articles back in the day for Schools Week.
I remember that. Was it about maths? What was it about?
It was about science. I was pestering you for ages with about 3 or 4 rewrites because it was the first thing I ever got out there. So I've had quite a few since then. So I do remember. Thank you for being so patient while I kept pestering you about the EEF Science Guidance Report was the article.
Oh, that was it. Yeah. I remember now.
And thanks for coming, of course, to Research at Blackpool, which when we, by the time we put this out, will only be in a couple of weeks' time. So I think we've got 750 plus speakers. So it's a pretty big, the second biggest in the world, as Simon and I like to say now. So,
wow.
I know, yeah. So we'll very much look forward to seeing you there.
Amazing. Yeah, I look forward to coming too. I'm really excited. Thank you.
Brilliant. So thanks, Kath. Really appreciate your time. And like I said, hope to see you soon.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast pedagogy. Listening to teachers.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
So into this week's podcast pedagogy section, and I'm a huge geek and a huge fan of Kraftwerk and of Autobahn in particular. So for those of you who are not familiar with or aware of this album, let me tell you why it's such an iconic record. Firstly, as you will have seen on Twitter this week with me posting pictures and on maybe Tom Sherrington's t-shirt at a Research Ed conference, is the graphic motorway symbol on the cover, and also the slamming of a car door and the starting of an engine that precede the music. So side A is a 22-minute synthetic symphony, an ode to the possibilities of road travel that combines raw excitement, fun of the Autobahn, with notes of caution about the future. And the album shows Kraftwerk exploring the possibilities of the newly available synthesizer and is really an accessible track, and my kids love singing along to Autobahn. So side B features four instrumentals, which are a counterbalance to the harsh industrial feel of side A, and they trace a journey that takes in nighttime concerts, an eerie midnight walk, and even a morning walk, and to me, a sound reminiscent of the Clangers TV programme, which, if you remember that one, is back on again now. This record is 46 years old, I think, but it sounds as fresh as the day it's released. So get it on vinyl, and for the younger listeners, I'm sure you can get it on Alexa or Amazon Music or Apple Music or even Spotify. And if you listen to it, you absolutely won't regret it, and you'll see its influence pervading through lots of popular new music. So Kraftwerk Autobahn is on Parlophone Records and is available everywhere. Okay, into film. So this week in film, I'm looking forward to watching Greed with Steve Coogan. And as you will be able to tell from this podcast, I'm basically becoming Alan Partridge. So I'm a huge admirer of Coogan's work. And in this film, he does what to me is a thinly disguised satire on a quite famous former department store mogul in the lead up to his 60th birthday party in Mykonos. So it's featuring performances from Isla Fisher, and it's also got David Mitchell in there. I'm expecting an entertaining and probably quite crude film. Hopefully the perfect end to the first week back at school. So before we hear from Darren Leslie in the books section, remember the reason for this section, and we're looking into films, music and books, is to remind us all of Martin Rees' hashtag #TeacherFiveADay, reminding us that we all need to think a bit more about our well-being and our interest outside of the classroom. So remember to connect, exercise, notice, volunteer and learn. And hopefully this focus of the podcast is helping you to notice and even maybe to learn. So now over to fellow podcaster Darren Leslie, and Darren is going to be reviewing a book, which we'll talk about in a minute, but we're going to include links to Darren's Becoming Educated podcast in the show notes. So without further ado, over to you, Darren.
Hi Phil, this is Darren Leslie. I'm a teacher of physical education and a principal teacher of learning and teaching in a school in Clackmannanshire, Scotland, and I'm also the host of the Becoming Educated podcast. I would like to review a book today, and the book in question is an absolute barnstormer of a book. It is Life Will See You Now by Gavin Oates. Gavin is a keynote speaker and the owner of a company called Tree of Knowledge that look to personally develop both young people and adults and bring the fun back into work. Gavin has published three other books, Shine, Zest, and Diary of a Brilliant Kid, but this is the first book that he has written by himself. And in this book, he really opens up about his own life. Gavin's message is to challenge people to live life better than they have and to not be afraid of who they are and to, as he puts it, to blow their own goddamn mind for a change. He wants you to remember what life is like when you were 5 years old, when going out in the rain, when jumping in puddles was fun before you became a little bit old and a little bit jaded and decided to turn into a person that thought, I'm not going out, it's raining. In Life We'll See You Now, Gavin shares some personal stories that really, really get you thinking. Outwardly, if you know Gavin, he's a very extrovert person who shares his stories and his analogies and his jokes through his self-help comedy approach to his keynote speaking. But in the book, Gavin shares about his anxiety and also shares a little bit about how he thinks he had a nervous breakdown after the passing of his father and at the height of his success. He shares some funny stories around this to put some positive spin on it, but I think it also helps people realise that they're not alone in some of the things that they're feeling, and it really is a brilliant book to get into. It's backed by positive psychology, and it has a large abundance of childlike wonder, which is just like Gavin, and he encourages people that even though we live in a world full of pressure and ego and other people's expectations, we are extremely lucky to be alive, and we should really focus on kindness, gratitude, and just getting outside and playing and remember what life was like when we were young. And even though you're an adult, you should not be afraid to go outside and just play in the rain. I'd like to thank Gavin for writing that book, and I really would encourage anyone to give it a read.
Nailers, Netter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast pedagogy. Listening to teachers.
Nailers, Netter, just talking to teachers.
So just to finish off this week with some shameless plugs, and again, the shameless plugs are for Research Ed Birmingham. We'll be playing the Nailers Natter theme tune down the corridor to lure people in, as nobody really actually knows what I look like. And that's always quite funny, by the way, when people walk in, you can hear the audible sighs of disappointment when they realise what you actually look like. Yes, what you're looking for, listeners, is a young Ken Bruce. So be looking out for that, but you'll hear the Nailers Natter tune playing down the corridor, and I'll be talking about behaviour, ideology, evidence, and pragmatism. We've also got Research at Blackpool, of course, coming up, and I'll be doing exactly the same thing on that day, although I'll probably be doing a little bit more fussing about the length of the lines for coffees. So, just a reminder and a thank you, really, for all of you for listening and taking time for those of you that did to review the podcast. Really, really appreciate that, and the one-star review has been balanced out nicely. Also remember to use your John Cat voucher this week, and again, the link on that is on the show notes. So, thank you again for listening, and see you next week when Omar Akbar will be the guest.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.